Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, all our listeners on Eagle FM. This is Mr. Josephat Kashindi Andreas, and I will be the one hosting the show tonight. This is Life Lessons, and I just want to appreciate all the my hosts who have been here the whole day, and I want to appreciate all our listeners, and just really, you know, just thank God for all of you for being part of our show. We are because you are here. Okay. So yeah, so without further ado, the number in the studio is 083-288-8401. Okay. 083-288-8401. Okay, so if you want to call in, you're welcome, and we look forward to having as many callers as possible so that we can make this show the best that it has always been. Okay, so what is the topic tonight? What we are going to be discussing about today, or what we're going to be looking at today, is basically just some opportunities that are found outside the borders of Namibia. Right, so it's relocation opportunities, and basically, how to basically just, you know, find other opportunities outside the borders of Namibia. So that's what we are looking at. So basically, we are going to just be drawing from some research we've done. We are going to draw from personal experiences. In terms of myself, I'll be drawing from those, and we will just be looking at as many aspects of the relocation as far as possible. Okay, so the first thing, let me just talk about the fact that we have a lot of unemployment in Namibia. As a country, we have really a lot of unemployment, and because of that, you find that a lot of people, we have, for example, we have young people who have finished school, and by school I mean grade 10, and some of them are no longer able to go back to school because of one or two reasons. There are so many reasons why people can't go back to school. One of them could be maybe they are dyslexic, okay, and they are not able to fare well in the school system, in the normal school system, okay, or in the mainstream school system. Let me not use the word normal, because then people will think the opposite of normal is abnormal, but that's not what we mean. We are trying to say the mainstream education system of our country. So that is the first thing. So somebody who is dyslexic or who have some learning difficulties might not be able to fare well in the mainstreams in the mainstream education system, and because of that, they might not be able to go back to school. And you know, a person like that can be just on the street. So that is number one. Then we have people who have finished grade 12. They have passed grade 12, but maybe they couldn't get any funding to be able to further their studies. Okay. So a person like that adds to the statistics as well, of people who are just staying at home or who are just on the street. And then you have other people who, for one reason or another, they just don't feel like they want to go to school. Maybe they are taking gap year, which is one of the things that people do nowadays. I remember the time that we were in school, there was nothing like gap year. I mean, I got to know the word just because, I was, you know, I stumbled upon a word, the word gap year, to take a gap year. And because people talk about it, then I got to know what it is about. But the time we were in school, there was no gap year, because like you finish school, you just want to finish. You finish grade 10, you want to continue to grade 11. You finish grade 11, you want to continue to 12. You finish 12, you want to go to university the following year. You basically just take the 2 months holiday that you have between December and February when you are going to register for to be able to go to university, for example. So with those, you see, we've had a lot of you know, people finishing university even or college while they are still younger, yeah, and then they get into the job market while they are still young. But these days, you find young people say, oh, no, I don't want to go to university. I'd want to figure out what it is that I want to do, you know, after grade 12. And I'll take a year, or I'll take 2 years, or I'll take 3 years to just chill at home. And sometimes it becomes a bit dangerous for young people, because once you go into the whole thing of staying at home, you might start now drinking, you know, you might start partying, you might start doing all sorts of things that might end up becoming detrimental to your future. And because of that, you find that it can become a bit of a problem for you. Okay, so people like that will end up, I mean, I've seen it live that a lot of people who take gap year, sometimes they don't end up going back to school. By the end of the gap year, if they've taken a year off or 2 years or three, then maybe they get a job to work in a shop as a teller, or to do one of these other works that are important, but they don't require much educational qualification. And for some people, they would never go back to school. I've seen so many cases of people like that who could not go back to school because of that. So, yeah, I think we have a lot of cases how people end up being at home. And then we have our graduates, people who have graduated from school, from colleges, people who have graduated from university, and they couldn't find employment. They couldn't find employment anywhere in Namibia. Some would find a couple of jobs and things like that, but a lot of them couldn't find employment properly. And because of that, you find that sometimes it then becomes an issue where the person is just at home. So that number grows on a yearly basis. If you, for example, look at how many graduate every year from NAST alone, and then you add the ones from IUM, you add the ones from the University of Namibia or UNAM, and then you add from Stadio, you add from other institutions, from Triumphant College, you find that in a year you can have a very, very big, large number of people who are just sitting at home and they don't have any jobs. So it just becomes a bit of a problem in terms of adding to the number of people who don't have jobs. So you find that the psychological thing then that becomes from that situation, or that comes from that situation, is that people will think that, oh, there are no jobs in Namibia, so then they just stay at home. They just stay at home, really. They don't look elsewhere. They don't do anything else, but they just stay at home. Yeah. So with those, it becomes a bit of a problem, you know, because then the number of unemployed people just continues growing on a yearly basis. And then we start going to the government, and then we start saying, well, the government should provide jobs. But you see, the government is just the government, and they can only provide a number of jobs. They can't employ anybody, everybody. Even if you happen to find a perfect government, I don't even know where such government exists in the world, but even if you were to find a perfect government, there would not be jobs for everyone. There will still be people who are unemployed. So, so then you find people saying, okay, the private sector should employ people, you know, and all that. And then it becomes a real challenge, you know, because when that happens, then you still don't have jobs, and there aren't a lot of jobs around, and people will still be on the streets. So basically tonight's topic is, you know, tonight's topic stems from that, to say that if there are no opportunities here for employment in Namibia, there are places where elsewhere in the world where there are lots of jobs, and we'll be looking at those things, and we'll be looking at why, for example, in Namibia we don't have a lot of jobs, but for example, if you go to Germany or you go to the UK or the US or Canada or Australia or any other of those big economies, big countries, you might find that they have a lot of jobs, And that is where now a lot of people would say, oh no, but why would people say that there are lots of jobs there when they also have their own people? Yeah. There are lots of reasons why that is the case. So we will be looking at all those things to just, you know, give a bit of a scenario or different scenarios why there are opportunities abroad. Yeah. So again, if you are joining us you've just joined us now. Again, the number in the studio is 083-288-401. Okay, so that's the number you should call, and we will be happy to hear from you so that you can make your contribution, so that we can look at maybe if you have a question or you have a contribution that you want to make.
Care that builds with you. That's the rollover benefit from NHB. When you claim less than a defined amount of your day-to-day benefits in a year, the unused amount is carried over for the next year, like a savings account for your health. You can use your rollover benefit in many ways, from co-payments to medical costs usually not covered, even contribution holidays. Learn more at nhb.com.na. T's and C's apply. NHB, rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHB, we're about you.
Okay, welcome back. This is again Mr. Joseph Atkashindi Andreas, and I'm your host for the Life Lessons Show tonight on Eagle FM. So we were talking about the opportunities to relocate abroad. So I just wanted to say, well, the fact that you can't find a job in Namibia, right? It doesn't mean that you can't find a job elsewhere. Okay. It just means that you can't find one in Namibia. But if you were to look elsewhere, maybe you want to go abroad and things like that, you can actually do that and be able to get a job. Now, I'm speaking from personal experience, because a few years ago, I was able to apply for what they called at the time working holiday visa, to go and work in the United Kingdom. Okay. And I applied for that one. It needed a lot of money. And I managed to get, because I was a school teacher at the time, and I was getting paid very little money. I think my take-home salary at the time was about 4,600 Namibia dollars per month, right? That's what I was taking home after all the deductions. But I didn't have any loans or anything like that, but it's just the deductions of the tax and the GIPF and Social Security and all this medical aid and all that, right? And I remember that when I set a goal, I told myself, I said, well, I need to go to the UK. Now, the reason why I went to the UK wasn't because I really wanted to work there. I actually just wanted to go and live there, right? Because I fell in love with the English language when I was a university student, because when I went to university, number one, when I passed grade 12 to go to university, I was supposed to go and do law, right? But then I couldn't get a good symbol in English. So I ended up getting at the time UNAM was asking for a B or better in English for you to go and do law, and over 30 points in five subjects. So I had my 30 points in five subjects, but I couldn't, secure a B in English. Now, my background in terms of that is that I went to a school that is in the northern part of Namibia. And even though it was in Otapi, David Sharma Secondary School, that school was mostly rural. Because I remember we had very, very few books in the library. We had, we didn't have a lot of, support. I remember some of my teachers were not very qualified to teach grade 12. Imagine if you have a teacher who is teaching you, a particular subject, for example, that, the teacher ended in grade 10. They finished only grade 10. They didn't go to 11 and 12, but they are teaching you in grade 12, for example, or grade 11, right? That's the kind of scenario that we had generally there. Okay. I'm not saying that my teachers said that's cool. All of them were, but we had a few teachers who, had a bit of that. And, you know, so my exposure to the English language wasn't very good. One, number two, the myself, because I'm coming from a background where the last two schools that I was at are schools that didn't have, like, my primary school didn't have electricity. Okay, we didn't have electricity at school and things like that. So it, all those things contributed, and they compounded into the whole thing of me becoming like not being able to get very, very good symbol in English. And yeah, so because of that, I opted to then go and study just to become a teacher then, because I had over 30 points in five subjects, but I didn't get a B symbol. So I was actually conditionally accepted to do law because I applied after the August exam, after we had the mock exam, what we used to call the mock exam, and I was conditionally accepted to do law at UNAM on the condition that I have a B symbol in English and over 30 points in five subjects. So by the time I finished my grade 12 exam and then went on to wait for my results. By the time the results came, I found that I didn't have, I couldn't get a B symbol or better, right? So, and because of that, then the University of Namibia said, well, if you don't have a B symbol or better, even though you have over 30 points in your five subjects, you still need to, you will not be able to be allowed to do law, right? Unless you go and choose any other course. So I then, out of frustration, I chose to go and become a teacher, right? So that, and a teacher for which subject? For English and geography. So I ended up choosing English as a subject that I would be teaching, so that it can help, so that nobody else would be denied an opportunity to become a lawyer just because they couldn't get, a B symbol in English in grade 12. So because of that, I ended up, studying, studying education to become a teacher and majoring in geography, in English and geography, and a bit of development studies. So that is what caused me. So when I went to university, then I started studying I think we used to have our first course was, was a core course that you had to do for a year, and it's called communication. I think it was called communication or something like that. Or communication and study skills, something like that, right? And I can't remember offhand because it's been over 20 years. So when I started that course, my lecturer, I had a good lecturer, like a lady from South Africa who was my lecturer for that. And then the following year, the second year, I went on to, I got another lecturer, and I think I had Miss Helen Vale. Miss Helen Vale was my lecturer in the second year, and she hailed from England. Yeah, so I kind of just fell in love with the whole English thing, you know. So I started reading more. I started walking around with a dictionary. I would watch a movie. When I'm watching movies, I'll have a dictionary there and stuff like that. So because of that, I ended up just falling deeper and deeper in English. And then I had Dr. Otala. Dr. Otala, I think, came from one of the African countries. I don't know if it's Kenya or one of the other countries. Or one of those countries in Africa, right? And she taught me a lot of good things. And we had Professor Elderkin. We had a great time with them. He's also from England. So as I got these people from England who were teaching me and my lecturers from other African countries, I just fell deeper and deeper in love with English as a language, basically. And that is how I decided to say, well, when I finish university, I will be a very good English teacher. And I went on to become a good English teacher. I remember, I think in 2003. Yeah, because I started teaching in 2002. So by the end of 2003, I think I had, I was the first teacher in my school, which, because I went back to my school, to David Sharma Secondary School, to teach there. That's where I did my grade 11 and 12. So I went back to the same school and taught there. And I think I was the first teacher to get a C symbol, to get a learner to get a C symbol in English in grade 12 final exam, right? So it started from there, and then everything was just history after that. Yeah. So when I was now teaching, and now you see, when you come from university, you are teaching, right? And as you are teaching, you are learning even more. Like whatever you covered in the 4 years of your bachelor's degree cannot be compared even to 1 year of teaching, you know? So when you're teaching, you are discovering more. You're discovering more about yourself. You are discovering more about the language that you're teaching. I was just discovering a lot of things about the English language. I wanted to know the longest word in English. I wanted to know different idioms and different expressions, different proverbs. I wanted to know. I just had that hunger to learn more about the English language. So that is what prompted me eventually to decide, well, if English is from England, why can't I go to England in order to improve my English even the more? That is what I ended up resolving to do. So I then applied for my working holiday visa to go to England. And then I got my visa while I was here. That allowed me to work, right? It was for 2 years. It was a 2-year working holiday visa. So I took that and I went on to England. And I flew there. But it took me 2 years to raise the money. Yeah, the money that I needed to pay for the visa, number one. So I worked for 2002 and 2003, right? And during that time, I was saving money like crazy, because they were asking for you to have over 30,000 Namibia dollars in your account that you should show when you're applying with your bank statement, that you have that much money, and that you have reserved a flight ticket. And then you have the money for the visas, for the visa that you need to apply for, because you need to pay for that as well. And then obviously you apply for your passport first, and then you get all that in that sorted. So I could not, that money was very difficult to get. So it took me 2 years to raise that money, as in terms of capital for me to, be able to actually then show that. Okay. So, then I went to England, and I remember I stayed only for a week. The same week that I arrived, I took a few adverts and I applied. And the first job I applied for was a security officer, right? And then I got that job as a security officer. So when I got that job, I immediately started working. But before I started working, they put me on training. So they gave me full on training, on how to, you know, just basic security, uniform security, procedures. And then they link you up to the police. They link you up with a different law enforcement because if you're working at the train station, for example, and it was that time when, after I started working as a security guard, it was that time when things were really hectic in terms of terrorism, when people were bombing things, right? They were trying to do these suicide bombers in the UK and things like that. So you had to go through proper security training. And I went through that, and they gave me my certificate, and then I continued working. Now, the good thing was that when I got there, because I already have had my working holiday visa from here, I was already allowed to work. So I wasn't going to be an illegal immigrant. They allowed me to live in England for 2 years working full-time, part-time, whatever I want to do. Okay. But the objective of the working holiday then was that you go and work, maybe work for 2 months, and then you save up money, and then you travel to France, and you just become a tourist, really, basically. You know, so that's what they wanted people to do. But for some of us, when you got that side, you know, you have a family here, you have your nieces and nephews to pay for school and things like that. So, and support your family or your mom, your dad, your siblings, and other people who are in your life. So I couldn't do a lot of traveling, but I was able to apply for when I was in the UK now. At the time, I applied for a visitor's visa to go to the US, to go and visit the US, and they denied me that visa, all right? And when they denied me the visa, the reason was that I needed to come back to Namibia and apply from my home country. I couldn't apply from England because I'm not from England. I'm only living and working in England. Okay, so that was my thing. And that was now the law at the time. Yeah, so And then I met a friend who was working in the bank. She was from Poland. And we kind of, you know, just became good friends. And then she had a sister who was getting married. And then she was like, oh, I'm going to Poland to attend my sister's wedding. So I ended up applying for a Polish visa, which I got. And then we traveled together with her to Poland. And that was a really, really good experience. My experience with the Polish people was that really people were, I mean, they had that African spirit in them, right? They behave like black people, like Africans in terms of just, you know, the human relations and things like that. I know that there were a few other places where when we were taking a train to go there, I think some small children had never seen a black person before. I mean, that's like 20 years ago. So it was a long time ago. So, and they would stare at me and things like that. But, it was okay. I mean, I could understand that.
You know, there's something about opening a chaffa lager that brings people together.
Yeah. And once people come together, the voices follow.
Ideas get shared. Laughs get louder.
New perspectives come up where you least expect them.
Because when people use their voice, conversations start.
And those conversations, they can refresh a moment and even shape what happens next.
So grab a chaffa lager and start the conversation. Chaffa Lager. Now we are talking. Not for persons under the age of 18. Enjoy responsibly.
Yes, welcome back. We were in the marketplace a bit. Yeah, okay. So I was just relating my story a bit about traveling abroad. Yeah. So I had a good run, you know. So I traveled to Poland. We stayed there for the whole 2 weeks that we needed to be there, and then we went back to England. And yeah, so that was really good. It was really, really good. But I'm just saying all these things to say, and then when people travel like that, when you go to Poland, for example, I could see a lot of things that I couldn't see in England. You know, there were lots of things that I just couldn't see. I remember one of the things that I saw in Poland was that like people were they would make this like sausages. Yeah, their sausages were really, really good. They tasted like African sausages. I guess it had to do with the fact that at the time, I think they didn't have a lot of genetically modified food. Their cattle probably were grass fed, you know, and things like that. So it just reminded me of home, you know. So you eat their sausage, it's just like you're eating sausage from Namibia, right? Which is totally different from the sausages that I was eating in England when I was there at the time. So you could see that there's a big difference. They are both European countries, but there's a bit of a difference there. One of the things that I saw was that like I mentioned earlier, to say that the Polish people had this thing like an African spirit in them, right? They love family. They neighbors talk to each other. Now the place where I was staying in England, you are in a block of flats, but your neighbor comes out of the house or is going to work and finds you outside, and they don't say hi to you. They just walk past, you know, and things like that. But in Poland, when I was there, I saw people are greeting, and they would greet each other, and I was like, oh, okay, so this is different. So now a lot of things I couldn't understand, right? Because I wasn't able to speak Polish, but I would ask my friend to say, okay, what did this person say, or what does she want, and things like that, and then she would translate into English for me what the person is saying. So I could just see that, you know, they would ask, how are you doing? How is everybody at home, and things like that, which usually you don't find. Which at that time you wouldn't find in England. So because of that, I had a really, really good time in Poland. Yeah. So the whole thing is that even today, there are opportunities to work in England. There are opportunities to work in all those big countries, big economies in the world. So, even in Poland, I've seen a few adverts where people are looking for people to go and work there, like people from Africa to go and work in Poland. I've seen adverts of people looking for people to go and work in England, to go and work in Australia, to go and work in Canada, school teachers, nurses, security officials, people in the construction industry, cleaners, doctors, people in the IT sector, people in the human resource management industry and things like that. So there are just a lot of opportunities out there. Now, let me just relay a few reasons why people have jobs there while we don't have jobs here, right? Number one, in Africa, especially in Namibia, well, but most African countries, not just Namibia alone, but I mean, this is representative of the entire continent. We have a youthful population. I think over 60% of our population is people under the age of 25, you know? So that is a very, very youthful population. So because of that, you see that we have a lot of unemployment because of that. In those countries, over 60, maybe 70%, it can even be 75 to 80% of the population, of their population in the UK or in Canada or the US and places like that. You find that maybe 60, 70% or 75% of their population is people over the age of 75. So that is the number one reason why, they have a lot of unemployment, because a lot of people have gone, have retired from employment. So that is the first one. Now, coupled with that is the fact that jobs are there and a lot of people do not want to work certain jobs. I remember working in security was not very easy. We were, a lot of us, I remember I was working for a company called Guardian Security Limited, right? Guardian Security Limited. I just haven't researched on it recently to find out if they still exist in England or not, right? But it was a very, very big security company. It was as big as how we have G4S here, right? And a lot of people that I worked with there were foreigners. Why? Because the local people just don't want to work security. They don't want to work in security, in the security industry. So I remember even when my supervisor, because I only did that job for 3 months, by the way, and then after that I transitioned into care work. I became a carer or a care assistant. Like a caregiver. Okay, in Namibia we say caregiver, right? So that's more understandable. Where you work in the nursing homes, you work in the, you know, in hospital, different jobs. Okay, you can be an agency where you register with an agency, and then they just place you to say, okay, you maybe for this week you are working here. You can actually have that job and you work into three different settings, maybe one in a hospital and in two different nursing homes in the same week, right? So because if you register as an agency, you register with an agency, you would actually be able to do that, to do those jobs like that, because they just give you a rota of the different places where you need to go and work, right? So so after 3 months I worked, I remember my supervisor, when he was just about to retire, he was a white guy. So he retired, and the guy who replaced him was a black person from Morocco who lived in England, I think, for a few years, because I could tell that he was in England for longer. So you can see that like you can go like the whole group, maybe only 10% of the whole group of maybe 50 security officers who are in the same site, at the same site, maybe only 10% of those are British people. And by British people, maybe 5% of the 10% is maybe white. And sorry, not 5%, but maybe you can say white. If you have 10 people out of 50 security officials, 40 security officials are all just from different countries. Some are white people, but not from England. Others are from Italy and places like that. But most of them were black people who were coming from different African countries. So that is how we used to work. And then you find that maybe only 10 people are British. And out of the 10, maybe there are only two white people from Britain, and the other eight or seven are black British people. Yeah, and those are the children of migrants, people who were born in England because their mothers came a few years earlier and then they gave birth there and the children are British and things like that. So that is what I was just relaying to say, that is one of the reasons why they need people to work there. Now, the other thing is that, the economy has, it's what we call the social economy. They give a lot of things to people, right? So I remember, for example, I had a friend from South Africa who was a mechanic, and he married a British lady. So they were married. And when I met him, he was already married and they had a couple of kids. And, because the economy, the whole British thing, you know, is that if you are registered disabled, then you can claim government money. Like you get paid every month, right? So this guy, because he was he was a bit of a how can I say it without being offensive? He was let me just say he was a little corrupt, right? So this guy did, what he did was he cut off, his left thumb. Now he was right-handed. So he took, one of the tools because he was a mechanic, right? And then he just cut off his thumb, for the left hand, right? And then he claimed that he had an accident at work and he lost his finger. So when you lose a finger like that, you qualify to be registered, as disabled. All right. So he did that. He filed the papers. He went through the hospital, obviously, first. You know, you go to the hospital, you get the hospital report, then you fill in the forms to say you got injured at work. He claims some money from the employer, just like how we do this MVA fund thing, you know, in Namibia, right? So he got some money to be paid to him for, because he was injured at work, even though he injured himself, right? He was injured at work, and then he, because he was married already, he was already in the process of getting his British citizenship. So, because he was married to a British lady, right? So, he then took all the reports to the government, and then he registered himself as disabled. So, because of that, he started getting money on a monthly basis. So he didn't have to work because the money he was getting was actually pretty much enough for his needs. Right. And if he wanted to do work, then he would just, he doesn't have to work for a company. He will have to work for himself. Right. So he started fixing cars for people and things like that now to make extra income, to make extra money, or to make more money. So, some of those, like now a case like that is one of those cases that make it such that a lot of people, because they see all these things, like if you just lose a thumb or you lose something, I've seen people who in Namibia here, somebody who is limping. Yeah. Like somebody who's suffered from, what do you call the other disease that used to make people, like maybe you lose, one of your legs become shorter or something. Yeah. Polio. Yes. People who have survived polio and they have maybe one leg is longer than the other or is smaller than the other, whatever. I remember my business mentor in the US, he suffered from polio and he has that condition. Right. So you find that in Namibia here, you can still go to work. You can still go to work and, you know, be productive. But in those countries, if you are like that, if you've had polio and it deformed part of your body, you don't have to go to work. You just register and then you get money from the government for the rest of your life, really, you know? And because of those things, like those policies of government, that is what contributes to them having a lot of jobs. There are a lot of people in those countries who do not want to work just because they know that if they are registered unemployed, they get money. And the other thing is that they have a system where if you look for jobs and you can't find a job, you just go and register. You register yourself as unemployed. Okay. Now, some people don't even look for jobs. Or some people would look for very, very high paying jobs. Then they fill in applications. They apply for jobs that they don't qualify for. They don't have the qualification for. They don't have experience. And when the results come back, obviously, to say, look, we can't employ you. We regret to inform you that you are not selected for this job, for the interview or whatever. Then they collect all those papers and then they go to the government and they say, okay, I can find a job. So register me as unemployed and then they get paid every month. You see? So those are some of the reasons why people don't work in those countries. People are there, but a lot of people don't work. And then they have this thing where if you have had a mental breakdown of sorts, you have maybe bipolar or one of these things that are happening today, you can still register yourself and still get money every month. They give you a flat, they give you money per month, and that's it. Okay, we'll go to the marketplace in the meantime. Stay tuned, and we are looking forward to hearing from you.
Okay, my turn.
Hold on, just let me finish my story. As I was saying,
my man, you've been finishing your story for 10 minutes now. Even my tassies is getting warm.
Just give it more eyes. Anyways, long story short.
Oh, hi. When you're talking, it's a short story long.
Short stories turn long. Go best together with Tassenberg. Not for persons under the age of 18. Enjoy responsibly.
Welcome back again. Like I said, our telephone number in the studio is 083-288-401. Okay? 083-288-401. Okay? That's our number in the studio, and I look forward to receiving a couple of calls from our listeners. So we are talking about opportunities to relocate abroad. Okay, so I think one of the things that I need to really stress about is that if you are looking for a job in Namibia and you can't find one, start looking elsewhere. Now, the reason why I'm saying this is because people have ways of finding work abroad. Okay, there are agencies, companies that are helping people to do that, to be able to leave Namibia here. They can apply for a job for you, for example, and they can help you to go abroad, right? And start working legally there. You are not going to be an illegal immigrant. You are going to be a person who is employed legally to work there. And they will give you maybe 1.5 years. They can give you 2 years. But most employment contracts take two and a half years to 5 years. Okay, they can give you a working visa or a work permit that is 2.5 years. That is valid for 2.5 years, and you can go and work and then come back to your country. Right now, the other thing that I want to stress is this: that when you get a chance to go abroad to work, for example, if you want to go and work, right, you really need to work really smart and really hard. Okay, this life where because I've seen a lot of these things when I was in the UK, a lot of guys who went with us that time, when I came back, because for my working holiday visa was valid for 2 years, right? So at the end of the 2 years, I contacted an immigration lawyer. I paid a lot of money. I paid £10,000 to that lawyer. £10,000 is that's a lot of money. At that time. Maybe I should just use my calculator quickly to see how much that was. The rate was 25 Namibia dollars to £1. Okay, so 25 times 10,000 pounds. That was 250,000 in Namibia money. That is how much money I paid. Because 10,000 pounds, I would raise that in 6 months, right? So in my last 6 months before my visa expired, I raised that money and I took the 10,000. I paid an immigration lawyer. I remember it was a Nigerian born lawyer who lived in the UK, and he was a practicing lawyer. He was a solicitor there. And so I paid him 10,000 pounds, and he did my whole application process to renew my visa, but to get me a student visa that would also give me the right to work 20 hours a week and go to school. So that is what happened. I paid the money. He did the thing. They denied me the visa. And then he appealed and then they gave me the visa. Yeah. But you need to do that like before your visa expires. So if you are left with 6 months, that's the best time to start applying, because that those processes can take maybe 3 months or two, you know, or 4 months. It just depends on the workload at the time and the season of the workload. Right. So, that is how I ended up now staying for another 2 years as a student. Okay. And, then at the end of the 2 years, I came back to Namibia. I didn't get, deported. I didn't have to get reported by a friend, because people also report each other and things like that. So there are lots of, intricacies when it comes to living abroad, right? But the most important thing to stress is that it costs money. Even to relocate, it costs money. So people need to know that, if you are planning to relocate, you really need to save your money. And the other thing that is important is that, look at companies that are credible. Look at people who are credible. We have a lot of scammers. You know, we have a lot of people who are scamming people. I've spoken to somebody, just last week, who was telling me that they lost, was it last week? Yeah, last week. Yes. They lost, like there were four friends who were applying to go somewhere, and they found this lady who says she's an agent, a Namibian lady, right? In Windhoek here, right? It's a lady who helps people to go abroad, and then they paid 40,000 each. Okay. Now for her, she was lucky enough that she only paid 20. She had only paid half of the money. The other three colleagues paid 40,000 each. So that's 120,000 plus the 20 for this lady, because there were four. That was 140,000. Okay. So you can already see that it requires money. So this lady was not a real agent. She took people's money and then she ran away. I understand now that lady currently, she is in Canada. Okay. She has gone with people's money and she still advertises to say, okay, she's, you know, helping people and all that. Yeah. So we need to be careful, because there are lots of scammers out there. Scammers always find an opportunity. So the way they will talk, they will start imitating real people who are helping people for real, right? They will tell you, these guys, they study. They are very good at what they do. So they study other people who are really doing it, or if there is an agency or a company that does the visas for people, like that facilitates the acquisition of visas, right? These guys will study that. They will even come, they will make an appointment, they will come there pretending to be just a person who needs help. Then they get all the information, and then they go and make their own posters and put it on social media, and because they need to be convincing, to sound convincing, they need to look convincing. So when they do all these things, it just makes it so easy for people to fall prey to scammers. So you need to be very, very careful if you are going abroad. You need to find a company that's credible. The company must be fully registered within the different authorities in Namibia. And it's important for people to also have an office. So you can't go and just, you know, pay your money to somebody with a briefcase business. They must have a proper bank account that is in the company's name, not necessarily like a lot of these guys who are scamming people. They just put money. I mean, they put their own personal account, or they have some funny account that they have, and then they say, okay, this is where you should put the money. Or some of them even ask cash. I have a friend of mine, and his wife. They had money. They were asked to pay, I think it was it 4,000 or 5,000 or 6,000. I think they were asked by another lady again, who was a scammer as well. And they took the 6,000, they paid cash to the lady. The lady was living in Okahanja. She drove to Windhoek to have a meeting with them. And then she convinced them to say she can find them a job in a different country or whatever. And they paid their money to her. And that was the last they heard of from that lady. Eventually, I think a month or two months later, I saw on social media the same lady that my friend and his wife paid their money to. The same lady I saw being advertised on social media to say she's a scammer. She has defrauded people over 400,000 Namibia dollars. Different people who have paid this money to her, apparently for her to help them to go abroad and things like that. So we need to be very, very careful. So find a credible company, find a company that has an office, find a company that that has a real person who doesn't, you know, you see scammers, they're always in a hurry to get the money from you. You know? So they want to quickly have a meeting with you, and then you pay already at that time, and then they say, oh, if you pay today, tomorrow we'll start the process or whatever, and things like that. So you need to really, really be careful so that you make sure that you don't fall prey to these things. Okay. So, we are looking at the issue of relocating. Yeah. So the opportunity for work, there are lots of companies that are hiring, in different countries. And it's not just specialized job skills that they're looking for. They are also looking for just general workers. They are looking for people maybe like handymen or people, plumbers. I mean, any job in those countries, especially jobs that are more, that require physical strength. Like if you are a plumber, you are an engineer, you fix things or whatever, those are the jobs. You are a cleaner, or you clean and things like that. So those are the jobs that are available in those countries. Obviously, teaching jobs, yes, because a lot of people, again, because the economies have grown and these countries are big countries, a lot of people are going for example, for other jobs, like IT work and jobs in computers and things like that. Even though I know that there are lots of countries that still are looking for IT specialists and people who have degrees in IT and things like that. But the whole point is, those countries have a lot of jobs, a lot more jobs than our countries because of the population, the difference in population, the difference in the demographic, cases of those countries. Like to say that maybe 70% of their population is people over 75 years of age who can no longer work. While us here, we have a lot of young people who can work, who are more productive, and they can work. So in terms of work, that is one of the reasons why there are lots of jobs abroad compared to here. Okay, so the other thing is opportunities for studies, you see. So there are opportunities for studies. People can go for studies where you can get a fully funded scholarship to do your bachelor's degree, or you can do your master's, or you can do your PhDs and things like that. But there are also a lot of opportunities just for studies. Like those countries, for example, when they have their quotas for university, as you might be aware, for example, if a person from Namibia goes to study in Oxford in England, right? Oxford as a university is compelled by their policies of the government to have a certain quota of students who are from foreign countries. Okay. And these things play a very important role. For example, when a university is being rated at the end of the year, they are being rated as one of the best universities, or the top 10 or the top 5 or the top third university or whatever. All these things, they play a role. So because of that, they need students to go from African countries, especially, to go there. Okay. Now, one of the things that I have seen is that Namibian people are very, very well received abroad. I think we've had a few cases of a guy maybe killing his girlfriend in the UK, a Namibian guy who does that, or maybe a few cases of people, somebody turning up drunk at work in the UK who is a Namibian who is working there and things like that. But we haven't had a lot of those. And I remember even the time that I was there, they had a lot of respect for Namibians and South Africans and Zimbabweans and Zambians and a lot of other people from Africa, right? Because we were law-abiding citizens. I remember I lived in England for 4 years, and I've not been in trouble with the law. I never used to drink. I mean, I respected the rule of law as a foreigner, and those things helped a lot, because a lot of us from Namibia who were there that time, we never had issues. You wouldn't find a Namibian drunk on the street, fighting and doing all sorts of things. Okay, those days, because I think a lot of us, when we went there, we had a purpose. I mean, if you go to a country like that and your goal is to go and work and make money and further your career and further your study, your studies, that is a good thing, you know. And because of those things, I think a lot of us, when we went there, we were really just about work. And I remember everywhere I had gone, if I go and work in a nursing home and there was ever a Namibian there, those people would tell me, no, 3 years ago there was a Namibian here, and oh, Namibians are good people. That's why you are also like this. And because you turn up at work, you do your job, you don't cause problems to your colleagues, you are just, you basically you go to work and work and go home. Go to work and go home and do a good job at that, you know? So, there were lots of good reports that I have seen people talking well about Namibians, to say, oh, Namibians are respectful people. They are peace loving people. They are, you know, they are all these good things that people are talking about. So I think because of that, you find that we had great chances, and that's how our country was respected. And until today, it's still being respected. Let's quickly go to the marketplace in a bit. We'll be right back.
Get ready to embrace a world of possibilities at the University of Namibia, with a community of ambitious students, researchers, and innovators. Shape your future with a wide range of programs in agriculture, engineering, natural sciences, commerce and management, law, education, human sciences, health sciences, or veterinary medicine. Apply online at unam.edu.na. UNAM, open your mind.
Welcome back. We are still talking about opportunities abroad. Let me just give you a bit of a synopsis of what I've discussed. We just talked about opportunities to work, where you can apply for working holiday visa, and we spoke about the fact that you need to be really careful so you don't fall prey to scammers, because there are people out there who are, you know, maybe trying to just get money from people, really, and so you need to be really, really careful about that. So we talked about opportunities for work, and then we were going into the opportunities for studies before the commercial break. So now, basically, if you are to go and study, again, there are lots of things that you need to do, right? And I think the biggest challenge that a lot of people are facing today when they are trying to go and study abroad is lack of finance. Lack of finances, or lack of money, or lack of funding. Okay. If you are a foreign student studying abroad, usually you pay three times what the local students pay. Three, or maybe if you're lucky, maybe two times what the local students pay. But most of the time it's three times. I've just checked, because I was applying for a PhD, in England, and the money that they asked me to pay as a student, as a PhD student, was three times more than what the local students pay. So now, for the economy, for the UK economy, that is a good thing, because they are making money from the foreign students who are coming to study in their country. So you see that you need to really have money. I remember, like, I was making a comparison, like, I applied I got a quotation from IUM, for example, to do my PhDs in integrated natural resource management, right? And that is like in Namibia money, that's like $30,000 per year, right? That's how much I need to pay, and it's for 3 years, right? So that's 90,000 Namibia dollars. But in the UK, the same PhD that I can do at IUM, if I were to go to maybe do it in the University of Sussex or Brighton, you know, and any other university, Cambridge and stuff like that, that will be about £19,000 a year. £19,000 a year. So £19,000 a year is a lot of money. Okay, let me just do the calculation quickly to see how much that will be. So it's just a lot of money. So you find that it's really challenging for an African person to go there if you don't have a scholarship, especially. Okay, so the rate for the pound these days is about 23, and then it's 19,000. So that's about 437,000 per year that I have to pay for PhD studies. So it's just incredibly expensive. Yeah. So that is one thing that we need to be aware of. So the opportunities are there to go and study, but you need to just be aware that when you are going to study, if you don't have a scholarship, it's really going to be taxing. Okay. A few people can afford. I mean, there are people who have money who are coming from rich families, for example, and they can afford and they can do that. Right. And, and then the other thing is, like when I inquired with NASFAF, for example, to say if NASFAF wants to pay, studies for somebody, right? For PhDs, they only cover up to $250,000. That's all they can pay. NASFAF only pays. Well, that's the information I got last year, so I haven't checked this year. So I'm speaking under correction in case something has changed and that they are now paying a lot more money or whatever. But the information I got from the people who work for NASFAF there, when I inquired, they told me that NASFAF for PhDs can only pay up to $250,000. For a student who is going, let's say, to England to study. Okay. So you need to be very cognizant of the fact that it costs money to relocate. So that is why it's no child's play. You know, a lot of people just, these days people say, oh no, I want to go abroad, but you are not making the right, you're not making the right, the right choices in terms of finding money to be able to pay, because there is no free education like that for a foreigner. Unless you are lucky enough to find a scholarship, and scholarships are very competitive. I remember applying for the Chevening scholarship, for example. I applied for that, I think, about three times, and I never got the funding, you know. So it's not easy to find scholarships, but there are companies as well that can look for scholarships for you if you want a scholarship, and you need to pay for their service, because them looking for that. Just like there are companies that help people to get visas to go abroad, whether to visit or to go and study or to go and work and things like that. They are providing a service because they have to do so many things before they are able to get you these things, these visas for you to be able to go out. They have to have systems in place where they need to pay money on a monthly basis and things like that for them to provide the service that they are providing to clients. So it is really, really just one thing that you need to take out of this is that it costs money for you to be able to go abroad. That's why I relayed my story at the beginning to say when I was going to the UK for my working holiday visa, they needed me to produce a bank statement that has money that has been going into the account for my job. And I must have at least 30,000 Namibia dollars in my bank account. And that was over 20 years ago. That was in 2003. That was over 20 years ago. And so with that, you can see that. And it wasn't easy for me to find that money. That's why I said at the beginning to say, look, for me, it took me 2 years to save up over $30,000. And I had a plan B. I had plan B for it. You know, I was like, okay, if they deny me a visa, if they don't give me the visa that I'm applying for, I'm going to deposit my BMW. There was a nice maroon BMW that time. Those BMWs of those days, they were looking really beautiful. So that was my plan B, that like, if they don't give me the thing, I'm going to deposit my BMW and then and start paying. And I think they quoted me like $1,900. I think I was going to be paying $1,900 for 4 years for that BMW. It was a second-hand BMW and things like that. But lucky enough, I was able to get the visa, my working holiday visa to go to the UK and work, right? Yeah, so it is just to say that even when you're going for studies, it's even more expensive. Now, the other visa, we've spoken about the work visa, right? And then we've spoken about student visa to say you need to have money and you need to make sure that you are in a position to fund yourself if you don't have a scholarship, or you must have somebody who can stand surety for you and say that they will be able to, they will be responsible for your fund, for your to pay for your school, for example. Yeah. So, that is the whole thing. Now, the next one is just to go and visit. All right. Yeah. So a lot of people have applied for visas and they've gone to visit, different places. Some people come back and others don't come back, and then they get lost in the system, which is not good. Okay. So it is not good to do that. Right. But people do things just because they want to do things. Right. So, so when you go for studies, you are given the terms and condition of your visa. For example, if you are going, let's say in 2026 and you are going to the US to visit, they would ask you to say, okay, once you get there, you have 6 months. From the day you enter the country, you have 6 months to stay there. Before the 6 months are over, and they stamp it in your passport to tell you on the date you are supposed to leave the US before the 6 months are over. So if you stay for one more day, you have already overstayed, so you qualify to be deported. So those are just some of the rules that they put, the ground rules that they put for visitors, right? Yeah. So now the different countries have different visitors visa, okay? That they give to their visitors. So, for example, the US up to now their visitors visa is about 5 years, okay? But they have also changed. I think when Trump came, the Trump administration took over, they started, they changed the to say if you are going for a shorter period of time, they can also just give you a visa for 6 months. But most of the visas that they've been giving as until before Trump took over, right? Which is I think 2024 somewhere, towards the end of 2024, they have been giving 5 years. Even if you are going to attend a conference in the US, you get a five-year visitor's visa, which means then that you are allowed to go to the US as many times for the next 5 years. You go and come back to your country as long as you don't stay longer than 6 months that they tell you to stay. So some people, what they do is they go to the US, they stay for 6 months, and then they visit, they do whatever they are doing, and then they come back. Then once you come back, before your 6 months are over, yeah, you can go back again. Any other time, you can go back and, you know, so you, for the next 5 years, you are allowed to go to the US as many times as possible and come back. As long as you don't overstay the 6 months period that you are given as a visitor. Okay. So, so those are some of the rules that they have. I remember for Canada, for example, if you are going to Canada, their visas, would be the same length of your passport. So if your passport is only left with 5 years before it expires and you apply for a Canadian visa, they might give you 5 years or four, right? If your passport was only done last month and it's now, like now this time, passports have changed most, from 5 years to 10 years now, right? Our passports are now valid for 10 years, right? So if you apply, let's say you get your passport last week and then you apply for your Canadian visa to go and visit, right? A visitor's visa for Canada. You can then be given a whole 10 years, meaning that they will give you a 10-year visa that can allow you to go to Canada and back for the next 10 years. You have the right to go to Canada as many times as possible and come back and go back and forth and things like that. But again, if you are given 6 months, if they stamp 6 months on the day you enter the country, or Canada, then you must not overstay. You must come back. You must come out of Canada. You must leave Canada before the 6 months are over. All right, before that date that they put on the visa to say you have 6 months up to which month. Okay, so those are just some of the things that are very, very important for you to know about the visiting visa. Okay, so I remember somebody who applied for a visitor's visa to go and attend a conference in the US. That person was given a 5-year visitor's visa and 6 months to stay in the US even after the conference is over. But when you apply, they will be asking you to say, look, can you, okay, you are going for a conference. The conference is maybe a week, right? It's a week's conference. So After that week, you are supposed to now come back to your country. But if you want to stay for a month or 2 months and you have enough money, you can show that you have enough money. And those are some of the things, like when you're applying for a visitor's visa, the one thing that they do is that they ask you to show your bank statement. You take your bank statement there, and there must be enough money. Now, the whole thing is, the more the money you have in your account, the easier it is for them to decide to give you a work a visitor's visa. Why? Because number one, when you go to that foreign country, you are going there to spend that money to help their economy to grow, right? As a tourist. Okay? So that is the first reason. They want you to go there with money so that you can spend it in their country to help their economy to grow, right? So that's number one. Number two, they want you to show the money so that when you get there as a visitor, you are not going to be stranded. You don't have accommodation, for example. You can't pay for accommodation. You can't pay for your transport. You can't buy food. You can't do upkeep, you know? All these things, that is the reason why they ask you to have money, okay? So when you have enough money in your account to show that you have enough money, they know, they are more confident. They will be more confident to say, okay, we can give this person a visa, because when they get that side, they will obviously be able to spend money. They don't have a problem. They will not become a problem for the government. Because you see, if you get that side and you don't have money, then you become a problem for government. Then people would, because those countries are very serious. If you go there and you don't have accommodation, you can't sleep on the street. So the government will probably, they have ways of finding people like that and maybe house you or something like that. And they don't want that. Okay. Because that is a loss for the government, as opposed to, you having your own money and you are able to pay for a lodge and stay there and you are able to buy food, you are able to provide for your own transport and things like that. So those are the reasons why you need to show your money. Okay. So the other thing that I need to mention, which is very, very important and critical, is your immigration history. Okay. Your immigration history is very, very important, because if you've had trouble in the past, immigration trouble. Let's say you were deported. Let's say, for example, you are applying for a visa to go to the US now, but then you already have a deportation history. You were deported from Canada. It is very easy for them not to give you the visa, because you have that. You know, these guys, they do their due diligence, right? They do a lot of checks and balances. So they will find out about those things. They find out about your immigration history and things like that. And if they see you were deported or you overstayed in another country before, then it's reason enough for them to not give you a visa. Okay, they can deny a visa based on that. Now, if you have gone through an agency that applies for a visa on your behalf, right? And we have agencies like that. We have credible agencies that I know personally that can do that, and they have helped a lot of other people to get their visas to go abroad, whether it's for visiting or for work or for conferences and things like that. You need to be honest with the people that are helping you. So if you go to an agency and you tell them to say, look, I want to apply for a visa. I want you guys to help me apply for a visa to go to the US. Okay. You need to be honest enough and tell the people the truth, to say, okay, I was deported in this year, in that year, because there are always ways of mitigating these circumstances. There are ways of dealing with these things. If the person know, if the people who are helping you know that you've had trouble in the past, they can look at a lot of other factors. For example, some deportations and immigration troubles, they expire. Like if you are deported and you stayed 5 years, after 5 years, your deportation can, depending on the country, your deportation can expire, and that means that after it has expired, you can still apply for a new visa to go to the same country that deported you. Some are taking 5 years, others 7 years, others 10 years. Okay, so when you have situations like that, then it becomes beneficial for you to tell the truth to the people who are helping you if you go to an agency. Okay, you need to divulge that information to them so that they know exactly how to help you, because there are ways of helping people who have had deportation history and things like that. Just like I'm saying, like they might even do an appeal. There are credible companies that I know who have access to systems, and they can inquire to say, okay, I have a client of this name, and this is the person passport number. This person was deported from your country 10 years ago. Is this still valid? And then they can ask on your behalf about that. And then they say, oh, no, that expired 5 years ago, or it expired 10 years ago. So the person can apply and we will not look at the bad history they had. Okay. So when you have things like that happening, you know that you can still have a chance to go. All right. So visitor's visa. Okay. So then there is this thing where we are talking about certain countries where you can go as a visitor on a visitor's visa. And as soon as you get there, if you get offered a job, okay, because on a visitor's visa, ordinarily, you are not allowed to work. When you go to any country as a visitor, you are not allowed to work, right? So when you're not allowed to work, there are certain countries, I know Canada is one of them. There are certain countries like Canada where if you go there as on a visitor's visa and you get offered a job by a credible company that is based in Canada, you can actually go to the immigration officials and take the offer for your job, and they can be able to do a work visa for you. They will be able to give you a work visa. Okay? And I actually know somebody who has done that just a year ago. Okay? Unless something changed this week. But as of last week, I've checked and I know that some people can still go as a visitor in certain countries and still be able to do that. Now, other people, what they do is they get to the US or they get to Canada, and immediately they get to that country, they then claim asylum. They give reasons why they left the country, maybe for economic reasons or whatever, or they say stuff, whatever it is that they say there to claim asylum, that's their business. But then again, in the US, when you claim asylum, you have the right to you'll be given the right to work. There's some paperwork that you will get, okay, I think that department is like Social Security. It's like what we have, Social Security here in Namibia. They have something like that in the US where you need to go to those offices and register yourself, and then they give you a letter that gives you the right to work. Why? Because they don't want to have asylum seekers who are just consuming and using the benefiting from the country. In other words, they are being offered money for upkeep, food, all these things, all your basic needs. You need to work for yourself. So that's why when you claim asylum in the US or in Canada, they register you, then you start appearing in court, or you going to court for them to review your asylum case, depending on whatever reason you gave them and things like that. And then at the end of the day, they give you a letter that allows you to look for a job and work, so that you are not dependent on the government, but you can depend on yourself by working for yourself. Finding a job and working to earn your own income so that you are able to look after yourself. Okay, so that's what a lot of other people do. Which is not good. Now, what is the biggest disadvantage of being unemployed, of claiming asylum? One is that whatever reason you give them to say, this is the reason why I left my country, my life is in danger, whatever it is that you said, you will not be allowed to go back to your country until your asylum case has been declared null and void, really, basically. Okay, so that is why you see a lot of people when they leave here, they go to the US and they claim asylum. A lot of them, they don't tell you the truth to say, okay, I'm an asylum seeker. They just say, oh no, I went as a visitor and now I'm working. Okay, so you need to know how people do these things. Okay, so you are not allowed to go back to your country because you said whatever reason you gave. It's a reason that you gave that made it such that you can't be allowed to go back to your country. So that is why your mother dies or your child dies. If you left a child here, you can't be allowed to come back here to bury your child because you are an asylum seeker there. And you said that your life was in danger in your country. That's why you left your country to go to America or to Canada or to the UK or wherever. Okay. So that is one of the biggest disadvantages. And you also, you will also be monitored. A lot of people will monitor you. Like they have a system there that, that monitors them. Immigration system monitors you. They monitor your movements, your everything. If you buy a car, you register the car in your name. They just have a lot of things that, that, so you will not be free. So people who love freedom, if you love to be free, you don't want to be looking over your shoulders all the time. It's not, it's best if you don't claim asylum. So it is really, really important that you don't do that, because then you will not have a peace of mind. Okay. Peace of mind is very, very important. And for some of us, I would rather be free and in peace, even though I'm not so rich, you know, and things like that. So that is just a piece of advice that I'm giving. So, and then, there are countries where if you claim asylum, then you will not be working. I remember the issue of the UK. For example, a lot of people who went to the UK to claim asylum, they were kept in a hotel. They provide a hotel for you. You have your own, you know, maybe a room and stuff like that. You stay there for maybe a year or 2 years or whatever it is until your case comes up, and then they say whether you are going to be sent to a camp or whatever. And they have also started keeping people in camps. So you need to be very, very psychologically prepared. If you are going to a country like the UK where people are being kept in camps, you need to really, really be psychologically prepared for that life. And in the UK, if you're an asylum seeker, you're not actually allowed to work. So what do people do then? There are these other characters, these are the people who are based in the UK who would maybe do something like, I mean, this is now what I'm hearing from other people who are there and things like that. They would say, okay, a person who is in the UK is not able to work. Now, let's say I'm in the UK now and I have all the papers. Some people actually do this, and it's illegal to do that, right? It is illegal to do that. So it's not advisable for you to do that, but this is what people do. So you arrive in the UK, you claim asylum, then you meet this person who says, okay, I can give you the papers to get a job. That person gives you their paperwork. Let's say a lady gives you, you are a lady and you get another lady to give you their paperwork. And then you use that to look for a job and you find a job. And then you start working, you turn up, and then the person gives you their own bank account. Because obviously, if you are using their passport or whatever it is that you're using, their identity document, that's the same identity document that you need to supply to the company you are going to work for. And the bank account should be for the same person, right? So you work at the end of the week, because in the UK, they usually pay every week. Then they say, you know, they put in your salary in the account of this person. This person is the one who is holding the bank account, the ATM card, and they have access to the internet, the internet banking and all that. So a lot of people who have done that ended up with this person robbing them. So if you are paid £500 a week, the person will only give you three, and then they take £200 of your money. But you are the one going to work every day. You are working night, you're working daytime, odd times, and things like that. So those are some of the things that you need to be psychologically prepared for if you go to countries like that where they don't allow people to work. Because then you can only work underground, illegally. And those are all the things. And those are some of the things that cause people to get deported from your workplace. You just went to work. Maybe you have a uniform on. You are working in a nursing home. And then the immigration officials will come there. Or maybe somebody gives them a tip, or somebody tips them off. And they turn up and they take you straight from there. You are not going to go home to say, oh, let me get my clothes or whatever. They will put you on the next plane to Namibia, like from there. From the place where you are working, where you are found, they will take you straight from there to the airport. Then you are being deported like that. Sometimes they take you to some centers where you'll be questioned and things like that, like immigration centers and things like that, where you'll be questioned. But most of the time, they will just take you straight to the airport. That's why I remember the time, the day when I came back from the UK to Namibia, I had there was a girl on the same plane who was deported from work, and she was actually she only had her handbag. She left all her properties there, all her things there. She left them there because she was not given a chance to go home and pack up or anything. She was just taken from her workplace to the airport. Okay, and then she was deported. So we arrived together in Windhoek with her uniform on and only a handbag. Okay? And the phone, right? So it's a very, very serious thing. Like that's why we want people to be careful. When you are planning to go abroad, you need to really, really think it through and make sure that you are psychologically prepared for all these things that are happening. Okay, so I think we should go for a short commercial break.
All right, guys. So let's settle down some. We need you to sing this song with us. Listen up, listen up.
God of creation, there at the start, before the beginning of time. With no point of reference, you spoke to the dark and fleshed out the wonder of life. And as you speak, 100 billion galaxies are born. In the vapor of your breath, the planets form. If the stars were made to worship, so high.
Just let me finish my story. As I was saying,
my man, you've been finishing your story for 10 minutes now. Even my chassis is getting warm.
Just be the poor eyes. Anyways, long story short.
Oh, hi. When you're talking, it's a short story long.
Short stories turn long. Go best together with Tassenberg. Not for persons under the age of 18. Enjoy responsibly.
All right, guys. So let's settle down some. We need you to sing this song with us. Listen up, listen up.
God of creation, there at the start, before the beginning of time. With no point of reference, spoke to the dark and fleshed out the wonder of life. And as you speak, 100 billion galaxies are born. In the vapor of your breath, the planet. So alive, I can see your heart in everything you make. Every burning star will signify. so will I. If the mountains, yeah, yeah, if the oceans roar in your greatness, so will I. For if everything exists to lift you high, so will I. If the wind of play you send it, so will I. If the rocks fly out in silence, so will I. If the sound of all our praise is still about shame, then we'll sing again 100 billion times. Oh, 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 oh. Son of salvation, chase down my heart to all of my failure and pride. You create the light of the world, abandoned in darkness to die.
Welcome back. We are still here in the studio, and the number in the studio is 0832888401. So that is our number in the studio. If you want to make a comment or you want to greet me, we appreciate you as our listeners for Eagle FM. And this is Life Lessons. Okay. So, like I said, the topic for today, for those who are just joining us maybe now, because I'm sure there are some people who were not with us from the beginning. And now they are probably just joining us now. Like I said, I'm Mr. Joseph Atkoshindi Andreas, and I'm the co-host with Miss Happy Juju here, but she is not here this evening, and therefore I am flying solo. Okay. Yeah. So, and the topic for tonight, we were just talking about opportunities for people, and in a nutshell, we are trying to say that if there are no opportunities in Namibia, if you can't find opportunities in Namibia, it doesn't mean it's the end of the world. It just means that some opportunities are not here in Namibia, but they are elsewhere. There are opportunities elsewhere. So you can look to go abroad and be able to find a job abroad, whether it's a cleaning job or it's a security job or it's a nursing home job or it's an HR job, or it's an IT job, or it's a teaching job, a nursing job, a doctor's job, and things like that. So there are opportunities elsewhere. So don't just be here and just wallow in pity and in obscurity and in poverty. Okay. So look elsewhere and go abroad and find a job abroad. Okay. Other people have done it, and a lot of people are still doing it today. And life goes on, you see. So one of the things that I was talking about is to say, there are people who live from here. You know, somebody leaves Windhoek. I know a lady who left Windhoek in March 2025, last year, March 2025. She got a visitor's visa. She went to the US, she was able to find a job there, as a cleaner. She was a cleaner here in Windhoek. And then she went to the US. She found a job as a cleaner. She started working there. And guess what? Her salary here in Windhoek, when she left the job she left here, she used to get paid $2,500 a month. She arrives in the US. She spends, I think, about 3 days. She finds a cleaning job again in the US. Guess how much the salary was or is? $68,000 a month. Okay, that's just one job that she does in the morning from 9 to 5. And then she found another job. Okay, she found another job in the US in the night where she works like from 7 to 12. Okay? 7 p.m. to 12 midnight. And then she goes home, she sleeps, and then she wakes up by 8 or so, and then she's at the next job. Okay? Obviously, she doesn't really look like she has a social life, right? But you see, all these jobs, you still have your time off, right? They give you time off. Where you work maybe for a week, you can take your holiday, you can take a couple of days off, you can, you know, there are so many things that you can do, just like you can do here, right? That lady saved up a lot of her money from the two jobs that she has as a cleaner. She, like I said, she arrived in the US on I think it was around about the 4th or the 6th of March 2025. By November 2025, she had sent over 750,000 Namibia dollars to her mother to buy her first house in Osona. Okay? That is a testimony, you know, and that is why, I advocate for people to look for opportunities elsewhere. It doesn't mean that if you are a cleaner in Namibia. And that lady, I think she only went to school until grade 10 or something like that. So she doesn't have like qualifications or anything like that to say she can get a better chance of getting a better job. You know, what are the chances of her getting, promoted as a cleaner when she was, and she wasn't working for government. She was working for a small company that gets little tenders to go into offices for people to clean, to clean offices. So she was working for a small cleaning company that got some tenders, and they, and that company's workers, would go into certain buildings, certain small businesses to clean. And that's why she was getting paid 2,500 here in Namibia. Okay. So is it worthy of your attention to go abroad and look for a cleaning job abroad if you're a cleaner in Namibia? I certainly think it is. But that's my personal opinion. That's why I want to hear from our listeners, you know. So do you think it's worth it to leave Namibia and go to another country and do a job as a cleaner? Especially in the light of the testimony I just shared, where somebody could work for about 8 months or 9 months, and they buy a house cash here in Osona, Osona is near Okahanja, right? But if that person lived here in Namibia for that 2,500 that they were paid as a worker, as a cleaner, they would not dream of even buying a house in the next 10 years, because that money is just way too small. It's way too small. So those are the differences. Like a job as a security officer. I remember when I was in the UK, my first job, I worked as a security officer for only 3 months, right? And then moved on to care, to become a caregiver in a nursing home, because that job paid about two times what the security officer job was paying me. That's why I left the security officer. But I used to get paid 441 pounds a week. Every Friday is payday, right? And that's one thing I liked about the system in the UK, right? As a security officer. Now, let me just check again on my calculator here how much that would be in Namibia money. Okay. So the rate at that time, the rate between the pound and the Namibia dollars was 25 Namibia dollars in 1 pound. Okay, so then you multiply 25 by 441 pounds, okay, that I used to get per week. That was my weekly pay. So that was 11,025 cents, okay? Sorry, $11,525. So I used to get paid 11,000 Namibia dollars every Friday. Now, if you multiply that with 4 weeks, then my salary as a security officer, basic security officer, I was not promoted or anything. I was just a basic security officer straight from the training. I used to take home 44,100 Namibia dollars per month as a security officer in the UK. Can you see that? So that's why I you know, people would say things. Yes, this is a very interesting one. It's good that I thought of it. people will say, oh no, even if you're making 44,000 Namibia dollars per month, the lifestyle there is expensive. The food there is expensive. So that money is still small. No, that money is not small. That money is not small. You know why? Because there are coping mechanisms that you evolve into when you live in a foreign country. One of the things that I did was, for example, when I was there, I looked for some like-minded people. Maybe we met at work, or we met somewhere, we became friends, and then we started sharing. We rented a house together. Three of us renting one house, and each one has a three-bedroom house, right, with a common kitchen and two bathrooms. So, the three of us who have different jobs came together because I was single. I didn't have children. I didn't have a wife and things like that. So I needed to live the basic life as basic as possible, so that I don't have a lot of expenses. All right. So what did I do? I said to my friend, look, let's rent a house together. So the three of us came together. We got a 3-bedroom house. We rented it, and each one had their own room. Okay. You use the two bathrooms. We share the two bathrooms. We share the kitchen. We share the living room. Okay. And, I was paying about £200 a month. Because the whole house was about £600, and you don't pay water and electricity if you are renting. That is paid by the house, the housing council or something. So we never used to pay for water and electricity. You just pay your rent. Once your rent is paid, you are good. Okay. And the other thing that I did when I was there was that I also moved, instead of living in London, because if you live in London, London is very expensive. It's a very expensive city to live in. So I moved over to the southern part of England. I lived in a place called Burgess Hill, which is just about 30 minutes from Brighton. Brighton is like the coastal town in the south of England. So I moved to a smaller town called Burgess Hill with my three friends. We got a house there and we stayed there. Okay, so sharing a house. Okay. Each one have their own room because it's a 3-bedroom house, like I said. So when you do that, you don't have to spend a lot of money on rent. So imagine if I'm getting paid £441 a week, I take £200 from there to pay for my whole month rent. Then I'm done for the rent. I still have £241 left. Then food was very cheap. There was a shop called Tesco. And there was Sainsbury's. Those two shops were my favorite shops because they always had sale on food. You go in there with £20 and you have food for 2 weeks. £20. I'm talking about 20 years ago. So, it's the value of money obviously keeps being devalued and on a yearly basis. But the whole point is that food was not expensive. So after 2 months of working in the UK, with that salary of a security guard, I was able to buy my first car in the UK. Second-hand car, yes, but it was a very good car. It was a 1.8 diesel Ford Fiesta. Yeah? That was my first car. So I bought my first car, and guess how much that car was? £500. I bought the car for £500. And £500 is about around about 15,000 Namibia money, right? Yeah, so I bought my first car, and now I didn't have to take trains and buses. And by the way, a car is a luxury in the UK. In those big countries, a car is a luxury because you don't actually need to buy a car. The public transport is very, very, very reliable, and it's very, very cheap. I remember when I used to go to London, because my college was in London after my working holiday visa expired, and I paid the lawyer to the £10,000 to get this immigration lawyer to get me a student visa. So my school was in London, so I needed to go to London. So you just buy a whole ticket for students, because they had student prices where you buy the whole, like, I think I paid £100, was it? I think it was around about £100 or £200 that I needed to pay. And once you pay that money, you get the train card, you get the bus card, you get the tram card. All these modes of transport that you need to move from the south of England to London, from Burgess Hill, Brighton, from Brighton, Haywards Heath, Burgess Hill, all those towns, to go to London. You buy one thing and it gives you access to the bus for free as a student, access to the trains, the underground, and the tram. So those are some of the things that I just got like when I was there that time. Okay. I'm not sure if things have changed now because I haven't been to England ever since then, but I'm just saying like it was very, very cheap. So once you have that, any bus, you can just board the bus. You go wherever you are going. And the buses, the bus system there was like at every bus stop, a bus takes about 10 minutes to get there. The next bus, 10 minutes. In 10 minutes, another bus. In 10 minutes, another bus coming from there, another one going to where the other bus is coming. So you can never be late until you, unless you are just a late person, the person who likes being late. Yeah. So the transport system in those countries is very, very good and reliable. And because of that, you don't actually need to buy a car. But if you want to buy a car, you can buy. And the cars are cheap. And I remember buying that car from a man who was a friend of a friend. Somebody told me, no, this guy is selling his car. He just wants to buy a newer car. And the car was absolutely fantastic. Everything was working. It was fine. It was insured, you know, all these things. And the insurance for that car, I think I used to pay about 70 pounds, was it? Was it £70 per week or something like that? Oh, sorry, per month or something like that. Yeah, so it was also not that expensive. So if you have a car that's paid for cash there, then you are able to survive because you only pay insurance and put petrol. And petrol was much cheaper then as well. It wasn't expensive and it was a diesel car. So if you put a full tank, you drive the whole month without putting anything. Okay, so coping mechanisms. We are talking of coping mechanisms that you can develop as a foreigner living in a foreign country. So there are always things that you can do. So these things where people just discourage people to say, oh no, if you go to England and you get the job, the money is a lot that people get paid, but life is still expensive. So you still need to pay for rent and what, that's nonsense. I was there. And I remember when I came back from England, I had over 350,000 Namibia dollars in my pocket. That was 20 years ago, $350,000. So I decided to build some flats. I couldn't finish them. The money got finished before the flats were built because I was building like five flats in Nongwediva, which I built in my niece's plot because she had a plot. I didn't have a plot of my own, so I had to do that. So when the money got finished and the flats were not finished, so I obviously found a job, went back into teaching. I started a network marketing business, and then that network marketing business started paying me. In 9 months' time, I moved from zero to about 8,000 Namibia dollars per month extra as a school teacher, getting my pay as a school teacher. But I had an extra 8,000 coming in from my network marketing business. So I started using that money and I finished the flats and then I put people in to rent and things like that. So it's one of those things that you can really do, like to say going abroad is not bad. It's actually a good thing and people just need to wake up to it. Okay. We need to wake up to going abroad. Go and find a job. Go and study. Go and visit. Sometimes when you visit, you go and visit, you stay your 6 months, you come back home. You know, the things that you see there, you can put them in action here. You can put them in practice here in your own country and you develop your country, you develop your community, you enhance your own family lifestyle and things like that. So it is very, very important for people to go abroad. So don't listen to people who will discourage you. Of course, you should use wise counsel. And know that there are also certain things, bad things that can happen in those countries when you go there as a foreigner, but it's not a good thing to just be discouraged. There are people who are still living abroad. I have friends who I chat with in America, in Canada, and I have people that have just gone even this year who live in those countries and they're fine. You know, everything is going fine. I was just chatting last week with a lady who left, when did she leave? I think she left 2 months ago. Yeah. She's in Canada. She has a job. She's working. She went as a visitor and she's working now. She has a job and she's making money and everything is fine. Of course, there are people who would not tell the truth. They would lie to people and say, oh, life is nice here, you know, and things like that. But there are also certain things, but it just depends on the choices that you make. So if you make the right choices for yourself and you go abroad, you'll be fine. You know, other people have lived abroad for longer than myself even. You know, and they're fine. And some people are buying cars and they're bringing cars back here. cars are cheaper in those countries. You can bring in cars. You can buy 5 cars in 1 year. I remember when I was coming back from the UK, I deposited 4 BMWs, which I wanted to bring in and sell. Eventually, I lost some of the money, the deposits that I put down, because when I did my research, I found out that the Ministry of Customs and Excise here in Windhoek, they didn't allow. They were charging at that time. They were charging 50%. You have to pay 50% of the value of the car to customs when you are clearing the car to come here. So because those BMWs were secondhand, I had to just go and cancel them because I couldn't. But I didn't do the research first. I was supposed to research first. That how does this work and all that before I could do I could bring in the cars, but I didn't do that. So it was a learning curve, it was a lesson for me, and so that's how it was. But if and then the last car that I brought that I drove there, I bought it, I drove it for a year, my final year of being in the UK, that was now in 2007. I bought that car in 2006, I think in November. And then I drove it for the whole year, the following year, which is 2007. And by December 2007, when I came back to Namibia, I left the car there, and a friend of mine who was back in the UK put it on a ship to send it to Namibia. And I got my car and I started driving it here again. And I drove that car for long. It was a Peugeot 406 coupe, 3-liter V6. I still remember. It was one of the best. It was a very, very fast car. Because that car was actually designed by Pininfarina, who is the guy who designed the Ferrari. So it was looking like a Ferrari kind of thing like that. It was a sports car, two-door coupe, right? And it was a really, really fast car, 240 kilometers an hour. And it would move from zero to 100 kilometers an hour in just about 5 seconds. in about six seconds. So it was a really nice car. So I had a good time driving it and everything like that. Yeah. So, we are coming, nearer the end of our show. So I am super elated to have been your host tonight. I don't know why people did not call, but so next time, I'm sure next time you'll call, you'll call in the studio for us to chat a bit and share our experiences and contribute and things like that. But it was a real pleasure for me to be here this evening. And I thank God for the opportunity, even for me to co-host this show, Life Lessons. And I look forward to having a lot more interactions with you as our listeners out there next Saturday. So next Saturday, myself and Mr. Juju, Happy Juju, will be here to co-host this show. I'm not sure what topic we're going to talk about next week, but yeah, it's coming. Okay. So I just want to say all the best of Godspeed. May you be blessed. Continue being a good listener. Encourage others to also tune into our Life Lessons and all the other programs of Eagle FM. It's the best radio station in Namibia. That is my opinion. All right. That is my opinion. It's the best radio station in Namibia. So continue to tune in, whether you are in Namibia or you are outside the borders of Namibia. For all of our listeners and those who are not probably listening at the moment, just download the app, of Eagle FM app. You download it and then you'll be able to connect and be abreast with everything that's happening, whether it's Life Lessons or it's other shows. Mind Matters, you know, all these things, all these great shows that are on the radio. So, so let me just sign off and leave you with a song by Hillsong. Okay.
Come on, we sing together. Your prayer.